case this morning is Beekman versus Beekman. Council may approach. Mr. Koenig, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you. I should like to reserve 1 minute of my time, if I may. Yep. Well, good morning. My name is Lyle Koenig. I appear here today on behalf of Fred Beekman. I must say that in 3 months, I will have been at the bar of this state for 50 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. But the case that brings us to court this morning is unique in my experience. I've never had a case before that was dismissed in this fashion. We thought that our unequivocal allegations were sufficient, or should have been, but as you know, this case was dismissed on the ground that the trial court said that my client, Fred Beekman, was not the real party in interest. The complaint says that Mr. Beekman dealt with the defendants as individuals. The defendant moved to dismiss on the ground that there was no oral contract, that Fred didn't own the rock, that it must have been owned by his corporation instead. And the court so found. The problem with that is this is pure conjecture. At a minimum, there's a factual dispute over the question of whether or not the parties dealt with each other as LLCs or whether they dealt with each other as individuals. And the rule is, as we mentioned in our briefing, the rule is that the non-moving party is entitled to all of the favorable inferences. So on that ground, it just seems to us like, if anything, there's a factual dispute. If we're entitled to the favorable inferences, this case should not have been dismissed on the ground that the defendants are not the real party in interest. Secondly, the court ruled that we failed to state a claim.
Before you get to that,
yes, sir.
So as it relates to the real party in interest standard at the pleading stage here.
Yeah.
There's discussion here about a factual challenge versus a facial challenge.
Yes.
This is at the pleading stage.
Yes.
What's the proper mechanism?
Well, the proper mechanism, if it's a factual challenge, the court is supposed to hold an evidentiary hearing, and we contend that a evidentiary hearing was not held. But even if you would conclude that it was held, even on the basis of the competing affidavits, we say that there's no way you can dismiss on that basis.
Well, this is at the pleading stage. Isn't it limited to a facial challenge at the pleading stage?
Well, there's some law, Your Honor. I think there's some law that if they challenge this on a factual basis, the court then has to schedule an evidentiary hearing, and we didn't, and this wasn't scheduled as an evidentiary hearing. In fact, as you know from our briefing, it's our contention that what the judge did was convert this into a motion for summary judgment. If he does that, then we're entitled to have an evidentiary hearing, which we did not have.
Okay, and then if you get past the real party and interest part of this, and there's a separate issue of indispensable parties, right? So
yes.
That's also a subject matter jurisdiction issue.
It is.
So in your remarks here, you point out the fact that there's a dispute here over who owned the rock.
Right.
That makes the businesses indispensable parties to the lawsuit, does it not?
Well, under the statute, 25-323, if the court if there's a necessary party that is absent, he has to, the first thing he does is he orders that party to be, that entity to be made a party to the lawsuit. He doesn't dismiss. Right. What he does is he orders them to be joined, and he didn't do that either. So on that ground, he shouldn't have dismissed either. Next, the court ruled that we failed to state a claim. As we all know, we are now a notice pleading jurisdiction. A short, plain statement is enough. Brevity, as I understand it, is to be applauded. You need to plead legal theory. Pleading legal theories is unnecessary. We think that our complaint in this case, under the law, easily pleads enough because the facts, if pled, would entitle us to relief. Dismissal is permitted only when there is some insuperable bar to relief, and there is not. For example, if there's an indispensable party, he could have ordered us to join that party. And the sale, and we say, and we said in our pleading, that the sale of the rock was separately negotiated for the reasons that we stated therein. Also, he dismissed on the ground that it's barred by the statute of limitations. It's not barred by the statute of limitations. There is an exception. A contract is enforceable for goods received and accepted. The rock was accepted by the defendants. They sold it, and they experienced a pure profit. Can you imagine the audacity of these people? They sell $64,000 worth of rock, and then they state in their affidavit, we never agreed to buy any rock. Well, you have to wonder what did they think they were going to do. They sold it. There's no question about that. They pocketed the money. There's no question about that. Looks to me like we have a valid contract.
So is the relief you're seeking to reverse and then for you to be allowed to file an amended complaint joining Barnston Quarry and Rush Creek as party defendants?
No. We're asking you to reverse and to conclude that we have sued the real party in interest, and the party real party in interest are these individual defendants. Your Honor, if you look at paragraph 9 of our complaint, you'll see exactly why Fred dealt with these people individually. He knew, as an experienced businessman, that what they would undoubtedly do would be to purchase this equipment and this rock. Then they would drain the assets out of the LLC, leave it as a shell, and then walk away from it, which is exactly what they did, by the way.
Well, then why didn't he do a written agreement with them to discuss the rock?
Well, I wish he had, but he didn't.
But back to indispensable parties for a second. Back to the indispensable party issue. When there's this dispute over whether the rock was a part of the business sale or, as your client alleged, an oral, separate oral contract.
Yeah.
Aren't they indispensable part? The decision governing the rock here is going to affect the business, right? It's either theirs or it's not. So don't we have to have the court go back and order them to be brought into this lawsuit?
I don't think so, because there are two contracts, Your Honor. There's a contract between Fred and the LLC with respect to the equipment. There's a contract between Fred and these two individuals with respect to the rock. So we're just talking about the rock. We're not talking about the other contract. So since we're just talking about that contract, we're just dealing with those individuals. And it wouldn't, so I don't think you do, no.
I mean, there's confusion even in the pleading as to where that rock should go.
Why
isn't that by definition an indispensable party when it affects
is there confusion in the pleading, Your Honor? I'm not sure.
In the pleading, your client acknowledges there was a separate business agreement.
Yes.
And that he tried to peel off the rock component and sell that in his individual name.
Yeah.
As I understand it, looking at the affidavits, the other party objects to that, and they think it was part of the business deal. It, somehow, the court's going to have to decide who got the rock.
And that's the whole vice of this problem. You know, we don't decide that at the pleading stage. This is a factual dispute, and usually we settle that at the evidentiary stage. I just don't agree that they need to be brought in. And there's just no point in it anyway, because they own nothing. So, you know, we don't care. We don't want them in.
Well, if the business is taking the position that they actually own the rock because it was part of that written contract.
But they're not, Your Honor. They're not taking that position. They haven't even answered yet. They're not taking that position.
So it's not a question down the road of, does the rock belong to the individuals or does it belong to the business?
The issue down the road is going to be that it belonged to Fred Beekman. He sold it to them, and they did not pay for it. And moreover, as the complaint shows, we even had an agreement as to how they were going to pay for it. They were going to pay for it as they sold it, and they didn't do that.
Okay.
And I'm out of time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Erin Ebler Rolfe, and I'm an attorney with Woods Aiken on behalf of the appellees in this matter, Ross Steppen and Rock Beekman. We're asking this court affirm the decision of the Gage County District Court and dismiss appellant's appeal. The issues involved are largely divided into two categories at this point, subject matter jurisdiction and motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim. I will obviously refer to the court, given the number of issues involved, to the brief that has been previously submitted by appellees and try not to restate those things, but rather I would like to focus initially on what I believe is really the crux of this matter, which obviously we spent the last 10 minutes discussing, which is the subject matter jurisdiction issues, and as time allows, I'll then discuss the motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim. First off, to address a question by Judge Welch as far as the difference between factual and facial challenges and the appropriateness of doing that at this stage. The first thing I would note is that in the motion to dismiss, which you can find at the transcript starting on page 12, specifically page 26, the notice of hearing, informed plaintiff that this matter would be an evidentiary hearing, that affidavits would be received and could be offered. It's also important to note that this was not the first time that this matter had been up for discussion and evaluation. This was try number three. There had been two prior attempts at this issue. The same evidence, Rock Beekman's affidavit, was at issue in all of the prior discussions and hearings. And so the idea that there's some sort of unfair surprise that there would be an affidavit offered at this hearing is simply false. Beyond that, the Nebraska Supreme Court and Nebraska law, when it comes to a decision over lack of subject matter jurisdiction, is clear that there is a difference between a facial challenge in which the plaintiff's allegations in the complaint are given a presumption of truth and a factual challenge. There's nothing that I'm aware of that says that factual challenge cannot be made early on. And in fact, when we look at the concept of subject matter jurisdiction, that is something that ought to be raised as soon as it is at issue. And in this case, there is a significant dispute among the parties about whether the rock even existed, quite frankly. And that is also why these rules of law apply and why they exist, why the statute of frauds exists. Our clients, should this matter go forward, would take the position there was no rock for them to sell. We don't have to get there, though, because quite frankly, the basic concept of subject matter jurisdiction is lacking. And that's the other point that was raised during the oral argument here. The argument was made that the trial court had the obligation to order the necessary and indispensable parties be joined. That's not correct. Under TNT Cattle Company Incorporated versus Fife, which is 304 Nebraska 890, decided in 2020, the Nebraska Supreme Court said that the burden is on the plaintiff to join all indispensable parties. And when we look back over the three total times that this matter has been brought up, every time the plaintiff was told, you need to join Barnston Quarry LLC and Rush Creek LLC. Every time he chose not to do so. during the oral argument on this matter. Judge Schreiner actually asked him, why don't you just join? He said he wasn't going to. We don't know exactly what's going through plaintiff's mind in this matter as to why he doesn't want, for instance, this matter to be possibly heard where the money goes to the LLC.
So let me interrupt you 1 second. Sure. So 35.323, though, does state that the court, if the court finds that there's an indispensable party, the court is to order that they're brought in. I mean, doesn't the court have to order they get brought in as opposed to dismissing the claim?
He also gave the plaintiff multiple opportunities to do that, to bring them in. And the plaintiff told the judge point blank that he did not want to do that. And so from that standpoint, that's a litigation strategy choice. And if that's the choice that's made by the plaintiff, it's his choice to suffer from it, quite frankly.
Did the court order him to bring them in?
There was never an order made, no, Your Honor. There was not. But I will say again, that TNT Cattle case makes clear that the burden's on the plaintiff to join those indispensable parties.
There wasn't even an order granting the plaintiff leave to bring in the indispensable parties if it chose to?
There was an order allowing an amendment at one point in the prior litigation to that could be filed, and at that point the plaintiff could have done so had he chosen to. But again, the plaintiff chose not to do it.
But there was not such an order in this case?
No, there was not.
Okay.
But you agree that the businesses are indispensable parties?
Absolutely. Okay. They're indispensable parties. Because in this case, Your Honor, let's assume this moves forward. And going to Judge Reedman's question about does it matter who owns the rock? Okay, let's assume the rock exists, which is a big assumption in this case, okay? If the rock exists and was sold, who has to pay? And who does it pay? If they pay Fred Beekman when the allegations in the complaint say that the rock and the equipment were concomitant part of the sale, that it was all part of one business, can Barnston Query then come back and sue my clients for failure to pay for the rock again? Or if the defendants, individuals, are ordered to pay, right, can they then make a case essentially against their own corporation for indemnification or contribution or some variation thereof? That's why we have this rule of necessary and indispensable parties.
Right. I have to unpack one more procedural issue. So this issue of a facial versus a factual challenge. So there's some Supreme Court authority out there that talks about a subject matter jurisdiction attack, real party in interest, at the pleading stage is a facial challenge. Is it your position that at the pleading stage, you still have a right to convert it to a factual challenge at that point?
Yes, Your Honor. My understanding is we've obviously noticed this up for three different times as an evidentiary hearing. There was never an objection made by the plaintiff to the concept that it was going to be an evidentiary hearing. And the fact of the matter is there are certain things that when you look at the case law on factual versus facial challenges, they recognize that on a factual challenge, we can look at matters outside the pleadings. There's no policy reason that I'm aware of why you shouldn't be able to do that at any time. And again, the plaintiff never asked for discovery to be conducted, and there's never actually been a dispute, and I believe this is in the oral argument as well, where, for instance, plaintiff admits that all the payments came from Rush Creek,
right?
From either individual.
But at the pleading stage, you haven't done discovery yet, so there may be some discovery that needs to be had with respect to that. I don't know if that's the rationale, but... But your position is you can call it up for an evidentiary hearing at the pleading stage.
Absolutely. And if the plaintiff had wanted to get discovery, he certainly could have asked for time to do that. Never did.
So is it then treated as like a summary judgment at that point?
No.
What's the standard as it relates to those affidavits that are submitted at that point in connection with the pleading in a factual challenge?
Sure. It is different than a summary judgment motion. This is under the ultimate question would be reviewed by subject matter jurisdiction by this court would be reviewed de novo. On a factual attack, however, there's no assumptions of truth, and that's Branson Label versus City of Branson 793 F3D 910 from the 8th Circuit 2015. The clear error standard applies to factual determinations made by the district court in evaluating a factual challenge to subject matter jurisdiction. And so from that standpoint, the lower court certainly does have the ability to weigh evidence on a factual challenge to jurisdiction, and that is a part of a factual challenge to jurisdiction. And so from that standpoint, it's certainly different than a summary judgment standard where the plaintiff or the non-moving party is entitled to the benefit
right.
of
so
all.
The strange thing here, you put in an affidavit. He did not. Do we still got to consider the pleadings then in connection with that factual challenge? Or is it just like summary judgment in the sense that you put one in, he didn't controvert it? So
under the case law, when a factual challenge is raised, the allegations in the pleading are no longer given an assumption of truthfulness or a presumption of the benefit of all reasonable inferences, things of that nature.
Are they considered at all? Can they be considered at all?
In this case, the plaintiff or appellant would argue that the fact that the complaint was a sworn complaint means that those allegations ought to be considered. And I would note that on page 6 of the court's order, he did consider those allegations and weighed them. However, as I believe you might have noted, Judge Welch, those allegations are entirely inconsistent within the complaint. Just to note a few things here. The plaintiff alleges at paragraph 5, plaintiff sold his quarry business to defendants, which was alleged to include both equipment and quarried rock that was located at various locations on the premises. At paragraph 11, the sale of the rock was a concomitant part of the overall sale of equipment and business. At paragraph 6 and 12, there was only one payment obligation. Quote, the defendants eventually paid for everything except the quarried rock. At paragraph 11, the rock was essential to the transaction involving the equipment sold. Essentially, Your Honors, the complaint itself acknowledges there was one contract. And under the statute of frauds, that means that alleged sale of rock for $64,000 and some odd dollars doesn't exist. If I may finish my thought here. Obviously, the offer letter that is a part of that one contract does not reference the rock at all. There's no other signed document from my clients referencing the rock. And once it's not a part of the original transaction, the statute of frauds prevents the plaintiffs from doing exactly what they're attempting to do here, which is suddenly add on an additional payment obligation that does not exist. And for those reasons, we ask that this court affirm the Gage County District Court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you.
How far did we take her over?
50 seconds, Your Honor.
Mr. Koenig, would you like 50 seconds of rebuttal?
I must say that I object to something that counsel told you. She told you a lot about two previous cases that were dismissed. That's not in this record that I know of. I don't know that you ought to consider that. The second thing that I want to tell you is that if you affirm this and let it stand, we're going to be, and this is why I think we have a great public policy argument, we're going to be fighting about this at the pleading stage. We're going to be having evidentiary hearings at the pleading stage again and again and again. We pleaded two separate contracts. I think our complaint is very clear. And in paragraph 9 of our complaint, we specifically say that why we did this and that it was our intention to have two separate contracts. And that's what we have.
Thank you very
much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both for being here. We will take the matter under advisement. You are